welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and the countdown is on. It's December. The number of shopping days remaining is shrinking. It's no easy job to find just the right gift, but as your literary guide, may I suggest The Old Masters. As delightful as seeing a work by one of your favorite painters or sharing a bottle of wine from a special vineyard, the experience of sitting down with a new work from a top author is a most welcome gift experience. My guest today, Patricia Cornwell, is indeed a master. She's back with her 22nd Kay Scarpetta novel. And all around the publishing world, the names we often reach for are out with new, very well-reviewed titles. I'm eager to share the highlights with you. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. The master, Stephen King, returns with Revival, a dark, electrifying novel about addiction, fanaticism, and what might exist on the other side of life. Over a half century ago, a small boy, Jamie Morton, met the new minister of his New England village. Charles Jacobs, along with his beautiful wife, would transform the local church. The men and boys were all a bit in love with Mrs. Jacobs. The women and girls felt the same about Reverend Jacobs. Then tragedy struck the Jacobs family, and the charismatic preacher cursed God, mocked all religious belief, and was banished from the shocked town. Jamie has demons of his own. Wed to his guitar from the age of 13, he plays in bands across the country, living the nomadic life of a bar band rock and roller while fleeing from his family's horrific loss. In his mid-30s, addicted to heroin, stranded, desperate, Jamie meets Charles Jacobs again, with profound consequences for both men. David Morris narrates.
Perhaps the coolest thing about the army was the box it came in. A cardboard footlocker and camouflage shades of green and brown, with property of U.S. Army stenciled on the front. Below this, Claire had added her own stenciling. Jamie Morton, Commander. That was me. I saw an ad for them in the back of one of Terry's comic books, she said when I was done screaming with delight. He didn't want me to cut it out because he's a booger. That's right, Terry said. He was 8. I'm a big brother, booger. He made a fork with his first 2 fingers and plugged his nostrils with them. Stop it, our mother said. No sibling rivalry on birthdays, please, and thank you, Terry. Take your fingers out of your nose. Anyway, Claire said, I copied the coupon and sent it in. I was afraid it might not come in time, but it did. I'm glad you like it. And she kissed me on the temple. She always kissed me there. All these years later, I can still feel those soft kisses. I love it, I said, holding the footlocker against my chest. I'll love it forever. This was after breakfast, which had been blueberry pancakes and bacon, my favorite. We all got our favorite meals on our birthdays, and the presents always came after breakfast, there in the kitchen with its wood stove and long table and our hulk of a washing machine, which was always breaking down. Forever for Jamie is like 5 days, Con said. He was 10, slender, although he bulked up later, and of a scientific bent even then. Nice one, Conrad, our father said. He was dressed for work in a clean coverall with his name, Richard, stitched in gold thread on the left breast pocket. On the right breast it said, Morton Fuel Oil. I'm impressed. Thanks, Daddy-o. Your silver tongue wins you the opportunity to help your mother clean up breakfast. It's Andy's turn. It was Andy's turn, Dad said, pouring syrup on the last pancake. Grab a dish towel, silver tongue, and try not to break anything. You spoil him rotten, Con said, but he grabbed a dish towel. Connie wasn't entirely wrong about my concept of forever. 5 days later, the operation game Andy gave me was gathering dust bunnies under my bed. Some of the body parts were missing anyway, Andy got it at the Eureka Grange rummage sale for a quarter. So were the jigsaw puzzles Terry gave me. Con himself gave me a Viewmaster, and that lasted a little longer, but it eventually wound up in my closet, never to be seen again. From Mom and Dad, I got clothes, because my birthday falls near the end of August, and that year I was going into first grade. I found new pants and shirts about as exciting as a TV test pattern, but tried to say thanks with enthusiasm. I imagine they saw through that with no trouble. False enthusiasm does not come easily to six-year-olds. Although, sad to say, it's a skill most of us learn fairly rapidly. In any case, the clothes were washed in the hulk, hung on the clothesline in the side yard, and finally folded away in my bureau drawers, where, it's probably needless to add, they were out of sight and mind until September came and it was time to put them on. I remember there was a sweater that was actually pretty cool. It was brown with yellow stripes. When I wore it, I pretended I was a superhero called the Human Wasp. Evildoers, beware my sting. But Con was wrong about the footlocker with the army inside. I played with those guys day in and day out, usually at the edge of the front yard, where there was a dirt strip between our lawn and Methodist Road, which was itself dirt in those days. With the exception of Route 9 and the two-lane leading to Goat Mountain, where there was a resort for rich people, all the roads in Harlow were dirt back then. I can remember my mother on several occasions weeping about all the dust that got into the house on dry summer days. Billy Paquette and Al Knowles, my two best friends, played army with me on many afternoons, but on the day Charles Jacobs appeared in my life for the first time, I was on my own. I don't remember why Billy and Al weren't with me, but I do remember I was happy to be by myself for a change. For one thing, there was no need to split the army into three divisions. For another, this was more important. I didn't have to argue with them about whose turn it was to win.
That was Revival by Stephen King. If you read forensic thrillers, I'm betting you've got several Patricia Cornwell titles on your shelf. She is, in fact, one of the creators of the genre. Flesh and Blood is the 22nd in her incredibly popular Kay Scarpetta series. Kay, as fans know, is a medical examiner. Patricia sold her first novel, Postmortem, while working as a computer analyst at the office of the chief medical examiner in Richmond, Virginia. Postmortem won the Edgar, the Creasy, the Anthony, and the McCavity Awards, as well as the French Prix du Roman d'Aventure, the first book ever to claim all these distinctions in a single year. To date, Cornwell's books have sold more than 100 million copies. Patricia's novels center on Scarpetta, along with her tech-savvy niece Lucy and fellow investigator Pete Marino. Over 20 years, these characters have grown into an international phenomenon, eventually winning Patricia the Sherlock Award for the best detective created by an American author. When not writing from her Boston home, Patricia researches cutting-edge forensic technologies to include in her work. Patricia co-founded the National Forensic Academy and created a chair in organic science at Harvard. She appears as a forensic consultant on CNN and serves as a member of Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital's National Council, where she advocates for psychiatric research. She's also helped fund the ICU at Cornell's Animal Hospital, the scientific study of a Confederate submarine, the archaeological excavation of Jamestown, and she supports a variety of law enforcement charities. I'm so pleased to welcome Patricia back to the Book Report. Welcome, Patricia. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you.
Why the title Flesh and Blood for your latest Scarpetta?
Well, because for a couple of reasons. One, I try to remind people that my books are not about the dead. They're really about the living and what the living do when the worst happens to people. So Flesh and Blood is a reminder that we're dealing with warm-blooded human characters who are very alive and working very difficult cases. There's also the meaning that it, this particular, the serial sniper cases I'm showing you in Flesh and Blood also have a direct threat to Scarpetta's inner circle, her sort of extended family, her own flesh and blood. She has to worry that something bad may happen to these people she cares about because of this extremely diabolical and gifted shooter who's out there killing people. And she begins to get the horrible feeling this person knows her and knows the people around her and may in fact be somebody she knows very well. It's also an allusion to her niece, who is like her daughter, Mrs. Lucy, who's a major character in the series, a computer genius. And Scarpetta begins to wonder, is Lucy maybe involved in what is happening? Her own flesh and blood, is she involved in these cases? And that becomes quite a roller coaster ride as we get closer to the ending.
Right. For years, primetime TV has been inundated with shows about Emmys and forensic and all the CSIs, for example. Has our national familiarity with basic forensics impacted the way you write Scarpetta today?
Well, it has impacted the way I write Scarpetta for the simple reason that in the old days, when I was getting, you know, back in the 90s in particular, I had to go into a whole lot of detail about every aspect of forensic examination because nobody knew anything about it. They didn't know what a scanning electron microscope did. They didn't know what trace evidence really was. And so I had to go to, you know, they didn't really know what an autopsy looked like. Now I am much more sparing in some of my descriptions and maybe try to show you more what it looks like through Scarpetta's point of view, because you don't need 20 pages to describe an autopsy or even for me to tell you what an autopsy table looks like, because you see them all the time. So that has made my life, my approach to these books, different, just as current events and changes in technology change what I do as well.
Right. Scarpetta now makes her home in Cambridge. What does that city open up for you as a writer?
Well, the Cambridge area of Massachusetts opens up a lot of fun things for me. It's the locations become characters. You know, they have interesting features and histories, and all of it gives Scarpetta a very rooted sense of place, and that becomes part of the story as well. What bridge she might go across, and what happens when she's there, and so. You know, and of course, I live there, so I ride with the, I live in the Boston area, so I ride with the Cambridge police, and I do a lot of research around there, but, and it's also the mecca of technology. You've got MIT, you've got Harvard, so it's really, I think it's a good place for her to be, and it seems to make sense.
We're speaking with Patricia Cornwell on The Book Report. You write so knowledgeably about weapons in the book. Where do you stand on the politicalization of gun control?
Well, I think that we need some voice of reason in all this. You can't buy a car and start driving it legally without some kind of training and a license. And that is in and of itself an incredibly dangerous weapon if it's in the wrong hands, as we all know. And the same should be true of firearms, is that we need just responsibility to make sure that, for one thing, if you're going to go out and buy some high caliber pistol, to me it's terrifying if you've never shot anything like this and know nothing about it. You run the risk of very bad mistakes, of terrible accidents, or of poor impulse control where you do something you didn't mean. So I would certainly like to see a more logical approach to how people deal with weapons that they're allowed to own. You know, I grew up with guns in the house. My brothers hunt. I've owned my share of them when I've lived in places where I wanted home protection because I lived out in the middle of nowhere on lots of acres of land. I'm not going to walk out with a dog late at night and not have protection if I need it. So I see both sides of the issue very clearly.
Your stories incorporate so much cutting-edge science, yet that never interrupts the narrative flow. What tips would you share with aspiring writers as to how you achieve this?
I always say you have to know a lot to say a little. And so I would say educate yourself. If you're interested in something, go research it. Go do anything that gives you exposure. Go follow somebody around who does it for a living. Don't just depend on the internet, because you won't really get the feeling of what it's like. You won't get the smells or the way the wind blows off of, you know, some location that you want to go to. You won't get the emotionality of it if you don't witness it for yourself. So that's what I say. Go out there and be an explorer.
Is there a typical amount of time that you devote to research before sitting down and writing each book?
Well, I typically will spend a couple months right after I finish the last book. I jump right in and start doing research on the next one and get the major heavy lifting out of the way. For example, I've got this ongoing scuba theme that has to do with the Bermuda Triangle that you see at the end of Flesh and Blood, and that will extend into the next book. And I already did the diving, the shipwreck diving this summer, and did some other things to get those out of the way as I begin the writing of the new one. But I also continue to research as I'm going along. I'm looking things up and investigating things right up until the very end.
You're about to take on some TV. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, and I'm so excited about this. I've created a character named Angie Steele. She's an MIT graduate who ends up becoming an investigator, a police investigator, when she has the massive disruption of learning that her twin brother is a serial killer. And he goes to trial and is locked up at San Quentin. And Angie leaves the world of technology, of big money-making search engines and software and all these things that she was doing, and she becomes a cop. I think it's going to be a really fun story with lots of great characters. I'm working on the pilot right now for CBS, and the hope is that Angie Steele is going to become a big series on their network and that people will get to see the same brand of characters on TV that they get with my novels.
When can we expect that on TV?
Well, the pilot is due in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned. Hopefully it's going to be filming in March, God willing, and then we'll hope it becomes a series that airs next fall. That's my hope.
Oh, we hope so, too. Any final thoughts about Flesh and Blood?
I just think that people are going to really enjoy this book. It moves very quickly. For people who've never read a Scarpetta, you can read this book and you understand their entire universe. You know the characters. You will not feel left out if you haven't read the first 21 books. And that's very important. And I think the ending's going to really shock you.
It certainly is a cliffhanger. Thank you so much for joining us today, Patricia.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Flesh and Blood, performed by Lorelei King.
It's Thursday, June 12th, my birthday, and I refuse to preoccupy myself with my age or how time flees faster with each passing year. There is much to be in a good mood about and grateful for. Life is the best it's ever been. We're off to Miami for a week of reading, eating, and drinking whatever we want, maybe tennis and a few scuba dives and long walks on the beach. I'd like to go to the movies and share a bucket of popcorn and not get up in the morning until we feel like it. I intend for us to rest, play, to say the hell with everything. Benton's present to me is a condo he rented on the ocean. We've reached a point in life where we should enjoy a little time off, but he's been saying that for as long as I can remember. We both have. As of this morning, we're officially on leave, at least in theory. In fact, there really isn't such a thing. Benton is an intelligence analyst, what people call a profiler. He's never off his FBI leash, and the cliché that death never takes a holiday is true. I'm never off my leash either. The pennies are lit up in the morning glare, fiery and too perfect, and I don't touch them. I don't recall seeing them earlier lined up precisely straight on the wall, all oriented exactly the same way. But the backyard was mostly in shadows the first time I ventured out, and I was distracted by my pouty dog's unwillingness to potty and by my landscaping checklist. The roses need fertilizing and spraying. The lawn needs weeding and should be mown before a storm ushers in a heat wave as predicted for tonight. I have instructions written out for Bryce. He's to make sure that all is taken care of not only at the CFC, but also on the home front. Lucy and Janet are dog nannies while we're gone, and we have our usual trick that isn't flawless, but better than the alternative of leaving Sock alone in an empty house for even 10 minutes. My niece will arrive, and I'll walk him out the door as if I'm taking him with me. Then I'll coax him into whatever she's driving, hopefully not one of her monster machines with no back seat. I asked her pointedly to use her SUV, not that it's a normal vehicle either. Nothing my former law enforcement, computer genius, power-addicted niece owns is for the hoi polloi. Not her matte black stealth bomber of an armored SUV. Not her aggressive 599 GTO that sounds like the space shuttle. Sock hates supercars and doesn't like Lucy's helicopter. He startles easily. He gets scared. Come on. I encourage my silent four-legged friend from his snooze in the grass with eyes wide, what I call playing possum. You need to potty. He doesn't budge, his brown stare fixed on me. Come on, I'm asking nicely. Please, Sock. Up. He's been out of sorts all morning, sniffing around, acting skittish, then lying down, his tail curled under, tucking his long, narrow nose beneath his front paws, looking completely dejected and anxious. Sock knows when we're leaving him and gets depressed, and I always feel rotten about it, as if I'm a terrible mother. I lean over and stroke his short brindle fur, feeling his ribs, then gentle with his ears, misshapen and scarred from former abuses at the racetrack. He gets up, pressing against my legs like a listing ship. Everything's fine, I reassure him. You're going to run around on acres of land and play with Jet Ranger? You know how much you love that?
He doesn't.
Benton reseats himself on the bench and picks up the paper beneath spreading branches of dark green leaves loaded with waxy white blossoms the size of pie pans.
It's fitting you have a pet that doesn't listen and completely manipulates you.
That was Flesh and Blood by Patricia Cornwell. Jane Smiley, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, is just out with Some Luck, a chronicle of the life and times of a remarkable family over three transformative decades in America. On their farm in Denby, Iowa, Rosanna and Walter Langdon abide by time-honored values they pass on to their five wildly different children. Each chapter in Some Luck covers a single year, beginning in 1920, as American soldiers return home from World War I. It continues through the early 1950s, with the country on the cusp of enormous social and economic change. As the Langdons branch out from Iowa toward both coasts, the personal and historical merge seamlessly. Some Luck is also the first part of an epic trilogy, a literary adventure that will span a century in America. Lorelei King narrates.
Rosanna hadn't complained about living with his parents. It was all Walter wanting his own place, all Walter looking at the little farmhouse. You could practically see through the walls, they were so thin. All Walter walking the fields and thinking that bottom land made up for the house. And the fields were rectangular, no difficult plowing or strange wasted angles. It was all Walter, and so he had no one to blame but himself for this sense of panic that he was trying to walk away from on the day before his birthday. Did he know a single fellow his age with a farm of his own? Not one, at least not around here. When you looked at Rosanna, you didn't think she'd been raised on a farm, had farms all through her background, even in Germany. She was blonde, but slender and perfectly graceful. And when she praised the baby's beauty, she did so without seeming to realize that it reproduced her own. Walter had seen that in some lines of cows. The calves looked stamped out by a cookie cutter. And even the way they turned their heads or kicked their hind feet into the air was the same as last year's calf, and the one before that. Walter's family was a bastard mix, as his grandfather would say. Langdons, but with some of those long-headed ones from the borders with red hair, and then some of those dark-haired Irish from Wexford that were supposed to trace back to the sailors from the Spanish Armada, and some tall, balding ones who always needed glasses from around Glasgow. His mother's side leavened all of these with her Wessex ancestry. The chicks and the cheeks, she'd always said. But you couldn't tell that Walter's relatives were related the way you could with Rosanna's. Even so, of all Rosanna's aunts and uncles and cousins, the Augsburgers and the Vogels, Rosanna was the most beautiful. And that was why he had set his heart upon winning her when he came home from the war and finally really noticed her, though she went to the Catholic Church. The Langdon and Vogel farms weren't far apart, no more than a mile. But even in a small town like Denby, no one had much to say to folks who went to other churches and, it must be said, spoke different languages at home. Oh, Rosanna, just 20, but with the self-possessed grace of a mature woman. He could see her profile as he approached the house in the dusk, outlined by the lamplight behind her. She was looking for him. Just in the tilt of her head, he could see that she had some project in mind. And of course he would say yes to her. After all, no fledgling had it easy, farmer or crow. Hadn't he known since he was a boy the way the fledglings had to fall out of the nest and walk about, cheeping and crying, until they grew out their feathers and learned to fly on their own? Their helpless parents flew above them and maybe dropped them a bit of food, but flying or succumbing belonged to them alone. Walter put his foot on the first step of the porch and felt his customary sense of invigoration at this thought. On the porch, he stamped two or three times and then slipped out of his boots. When the door opened, Rosanna drew him in and then slipped her arms inside his unbuttoned jacket. On the front porch, sitting up, he had just learned to sit up, on a folded blanket, Frank Langdon, aged 5 months, was playing with a spoon. He was holding it in his right hand by the tarnished silver bowl, and when he brought it toward his face, his eyes would cross, which made Rosanna, his mother, laugh as she shelled peas. Now that he was sitting, he could also drop the spoon, and then, very carefully, pick it up again. Before learning to sit, he had enjoyed lying on his back and waving the spoon in the air, but if he dropped the spoon, it was gone. This was no longer the case. One of the qualities Rosanna attributed to little Frank was persistence. If he was playing with the spoon, then it was the spoon he wanted to play with. If he dropped the spoon, and she happened to give him a sock doll, the sock doll that her sister Eloise had sewn just for Frank, Frank would fuss until she gave him the spoon.
That was a sampling of Some Luck by Jane Smiley. New York Times bestselling author Wilbur Smith returns to ancient Egypt in Desert God, a novel of ancient Egypt, a breathtaking epic that conjures the magic, mystery, and bloody intrigue of a lost world. On the gleaming banks of the Nile, the brilliant Teta, slave and advisor to the pharaoh, finds himself at the center of a vortex of passion, intrigue, and danger. His quest to destroy the Hyksos army and form an alliance with Crete takes him on an epic journey up the Nile, through Arabia and the magical city of Babylon, and across the open seas. With the future of Egypt itself on his shoulders, Teta enters a world where the line between loyalty and betrayal shifts like the desert sands. Evil enemies await in the shadows, and death lingers on the edge of darkness. Mike Grady performs the book.
I had nursed her as a child, and had shepherded her through her long and joyous life, counseling her and guiding her, giving all of myself to her without stinting. In the end, I held her in my arms as she died. Before she went on into the underworld, Lostris whispered to me something which I will never forget. I have loved only two men in my life. You, Teta, were one of them. Those were the sweetest words I have ever heard spoken. I planned and supervised the building of her royal tomb, and laid her once beautiful but then wasted body in it, and I wished that I could go with her into the netherworld. However, I knew that I could not, for I had to stay and take care of her children, as I had cared for her. Truly, this has not been an onerous burden, for my life has been enriched by this sacred charge. At 16 years of age, Tehuti was already a woman fully fledged. Her skin was lustrous and unblemished, her arms and her legs were slim and elegant as those of a dancer, or the limbs of her father's great war bow, which I had carved for him, and which I had placed on the lid of his sarcophagus before I sealed his tomb. Tehuti's hips were full, but her waist was narrow as the neck of a wine jug. Her breasts were round and taut. The dense, golden curls that covered her head were a gleaming glory. Her eyes were as green as her mother's had been. She was lovely beyond the telling of it, and her smile wrung my heart whenever she turned it upon me. Her nature was gentle, slow to anger, but fearless and strong-willed once she was roused. I loved her almost as much as I still love her mother. You have done well with them, Taita, Artan gave praise unstintingly. They are the treasures which may yet save our very Egypt from the barbarian. In this, as with many other things, Artan and I were in full accord. This was the true reason why the two of us had come to this remote and secluded location. Although everyone else in the palace, including Pharaoh himself, was convinced that we had met here to continue our endless rivalry across the Baobab. I did not respond at once to his remark, but I dropped my eyes to the board. Artan had made his latest move while I was still watching the girls. He was the most skilled player of this sublime game in Egypt, which was as good as saying, in the civilized world. That is, excepting me, of course. I can usually best him in 3 games out of 4. Now, at a glance, I saw that this game would be one of my 3. His last move had been ill-considered. The layout of his stones was now unbalanced. It was one of the few flaws in his game that often, when he had convinced himself that victory was within his grasp, he threw caution to the winds and disregarded the rule of 7 stones. Then he tended to concentrate his full attack from his south castle and allowed me to wrest control of either the east or the west from him. This time it was the east. I did not need a second invitation. I struck like a cobra. He rocked back on his stool as he evaluated my surprise move, and when at last the sheer genius of it struck him, his face darkened with outrage and his voice choked. I think that I hate you, Taita. And if I don't, then I certainly ought to do so. I was lucky, old friend. I tried not to gloat. Anyway, it's only a game. He puffed out his cheeks with indignation. Of all the inane things I have ever heard you say, Taita, that is the most crass. It is not only a game. It is the veritable reason for living. He really was angry. I reached down under the table for the copper wine jug, and I refilled his cup. It was a superb wine, the very best in all of Egypt, which I had taken directly from the cellars beneath Pharaoh's palace.
That was Desert God by Wilbur Smith. Throughout her blockbuster career, best-selling author Jodi Picoult has seamlessly blended nuanced characters and riveting plots, which, to quote the Boston Globe, have created stories that not only provoke the mind, but touch the flawed souls in all of us. Now she returns with Leaving Time. For more than a decade, Jenna Metcalf has never stopped thinking about her mother, Alice, who mysteriously disappeared in the wake of a tragic accident. Refusing to believe she would be abandoned as a young child, Jenna searches for her mother regularly online and pores over the pages of Alice's old journals. She was a scientist who studied grief among elephants. Jenna hopes the entries in the journal will provide a clue to her mother's whereabouts. Desperate to find the truth, Jenna enlists 2 unlikely allies. The first is a psychic who rose to fame finding missing persons, only to later doubt her gifts. The second is a jaded private detective who originally investigated Alice's case. As the 3 work together to uncover what happened to Alice, they realize that in asking hard questions, they'll have to face even harder answers. An ensemble cast performs the book.
When I wake up, Gertie is draped over my feet, a giant dog rug. She twitches, running after something she can only see in her dreams. I know what that feels like. I try to get out of bed without waking her, but she jumps up and barks at the closed door of my bedroom. Relax, I say, sinking my fingers into the thick fur at the ruff of her neck. She licks my cheek, but doesn't relax at all. She keeps her eyes fixed on the bedroom door, as if she can see what's on the other side, which, given what I have planned for the day, is pretty ironic. Gertie leaps off the bed, her wagging tail pounding the wall. I open the door and let her scramble downstairs, where my grandmother will let her out and feed her and start to cook breakfast for me. Gertie came to my grandmother's house 1 year after I did. Before that, she had lived at the sanctuary, and she was best friends with an elephant named Sira. She'd spend every day at Sira's side, and when Gertie got sick, Sira even stood guard over her, gently rubbing her with her trunk. It was not the first story of a dog and an elephant bonding, but it was a legendary one written up in children's books and featured on the news. A famous photographer even shot a calendar of unlikely animal friendships and made Gertie Ms. July. So when Sira was sent away after the sanctuary closed, Gertie was just as abandoned as I was. For months, no one knew what had happened to her. And then one day, when my grandmother answered the doorbell, there was an animal rescue officer asking if we knew this dog, which had been found in our neighborhood. She still had her collar with her name embroidered on it. Gertie was skinny and flea-bitten, but she started licking my face. My grandmother let Gertie stay, probably because she thought it would help me adjust. If we're going to be honest here, I have to tell you it didn't work. I've always been a loner, and I've never really felt like I belong here. I'm like one of those women who read Jane Austen obsessively and still hope that Mr. Darcy might show up at the door. Or the Civil War reenactors who growl at each other on battlefields, now spotted with baseball fields and park benches. I'm the princess in an ivory tower, except every brick is made of history, and I built this prison myself. I did have one friend at school, once, who sort of understood. Chatham Clark was the only person I ever told about my mother and how I was going to find her. Chatham lived with her aunt because her mother was a drug addict and in jail, and she had never met her father. "It's noble," Chatham told me, "how much you want to see your mother." When I asked her what that meant, she told me about how once her aunt had taken her to the prison where her mom was serving her term, how she'd dressed up in a frilly skirt and those shoes that looked like black mirrors. But her mother was gray and lifeless, her eyes dead and her teeth rotted out from the meth. And Chatham said that even though her mother said she wished she could give her a hug, she had never been so happy for something as she was for that wall of plastic between them in the visiting booth. She'd never gone back again. Chatham was useful in a lot of ways. She took me to buy my first bra, because my grandmother hadn't thought to cover up a non-existent bosom. And, as Chatham said, no one over the age of 10 who has to change in a school locker room should let the girls go free. She passed me notes in English class, crude stick figure drawings of our teacher who used too much self-tanner and smelled like cats. She linked arms with me as we walked down the hall, and every wildlife researcher will tell you that when it comes to survival in a hostile environment, a pack of two is infinitely safer than a pack of one. One morning, Chatham stopped coming to school. When I called her house, no one answered. I biked over there to find a for sale sign. I didn't believe that she'd leave without any word, especially since she knew that was what had freaked me out so much about my mom's disappearance. But it got harder and harder to defend her to myself as a week went by, and then two. When I started skipping homework assignments and failing tests, which wasn't my style at all, I was summoned to the school counselor's office. Ms. Sugarman was 1,000 years old and had puppets in her office, so that kids who were too traumatized to say the word vagina could, I guess, put on a Punch and Judy show about where they'd been inappropriately touched.
We've just heard Leaving Time by Jodi Picoult. In forensic anthropologist Temperance Brennan, Kathy Reichs has created a detective heroine who's brilliant to the bone. The Book Report is happy to bring you a sampling of her newest, Bones Never Lie. Unexpectedly called into the Charlotte PD's cold case unit, Dr. Brennan wonders why she's been asked to meet with a homicide cop who's a long way from his jurisdiction. The shocking answer: two child murders, separated by thousands of miles, have one thing in common: the killer. Years ago, Anik Pomerleau kidnapped and murdered a string of girls in Canada, then narrowly eluded capture. It was a devastating defeat for her pursuers, Brennan and police detective Andrew Ryan. Now, as if summoned from their nightmares, Pomerleau has resurfaced, linked to victims in Vermont and North Carolina.
when another child is snatched, the reign of terror continues, unless Brennan can make good on her second chance to stop a psychopath. Catherine Borowitz narrates.
The numbering system on the carton was different. I assumed the case was from another jurisdiction. A bit of background. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department had roughly 500 unsolved murders dating back to 1970. Recognizing that this was a lot of bodies and a lot of folks waiting for justice, in 2003, the CMPD established a cold case unit. Honor Barrow, 20 years at the murder table, had run the CCU since its inception. The other full-timers included a police sergeant and an FBI agent. A volunteer review team composed of three retired FBI agents, a retired NYPD cop, a civilian academic, and a civilian engineer provided support in the form of pre-investigation triage and analysis. The cold case unit regulars gathered monthly. As a forensic anthropologist, I work with the not-so-recently dead. No secret why I was sometimes invited to the dance. But I usually got a heads up about why my presence was being requested. A query concerning a set of remains, a question about bones, trauma, or decomposition. Not this time. Impatient and curious why I'd been summoned, I drew the tub to me and pried off the lid. Inside were hundreds of pages separated by dividers. I knew the headings on each of the tabs. Victimology, summary of the crime, crime scene report, evidence property collected, analyzed, medical examiner's report, witnesses, related investigation, potential suspects, recommended follow-up. Lying across the files was a case review summary written by Claire Milani, a criminologist and colleague at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I flipped to the first section of her report and felt my neck muscles tense. Before I could read further, voices sounded in the hall. Moments later, Barrow appeared with a guy looking like something off the cover of a survivalist manual. Washed-out jeans, faded army jacket over long-sleeved red tee, dark hair curling from below a neon orange cap. I replaced the report in its tub. Everyone stuck in traffic? I didn't invite the volunteer team. Though that surprised me, I said nothing. Barrow noticed my gaze shift to the survivalist and introduced him. Detective Rodas is down from Vermont. Amparo. Umpy to my friends. Self-deprecating smile. Both of them. Rodas extended a hand. I took it. Umpy's grip matched his appearance, rough and strong. As Barrow and Rodas took seats, a familiar figure framed up in the doorway. Erskine, skinny, Slidell, cop legend in his own mind. Can't say Slidell's presence thrilled me. Since Skinny works homicide and I work the morgue, we're often thrown together. Over the years, our relationship has had more ups and downs than a polygraph chart. His manner is often grating, but the man clears cases. Slidell stretched both hands in a "what gives" gesture and drew in one wrist to look at his watch. Subtle. Glad you could pry yourself free from the computer porn. Smiling, Barrow hooked a chair free from the table with one foot. That sister of yours does love a camera. Cushions hoofed as Slidell deposited his substantial derriere. Barrow partnered with Slidell back in the 80s and, unlike most, claimed to have enjoyed the experience, probably their shared concept of witty repartee. Barrow had just introduced Rodas and Slidell to each other when the door swung out. A man I didn't recognize entered the room. He had a weak chin and a too long nose, and standing ramrod matched me in height. His polyester shirt, tie, and off-the-rack suit suggested mid-level management. His demeanor screamed cop. The four of us watched as Polyester Man took a place at the table.
We've just heard Bones Never Lie by Kathy Reichs. From Chuck Palahniuk, author of Fight Club, comes Beautiful You, a novel about the apocalyptic marketing possibilities of female pleasure. Some are calling it a mashup of mommy porn, chick lit, and fantasy, rather like Sex in the City meets Clan of the Cave Bear. Penny Harrigan is a low-level associate in a big Manhattan law firm. She's got an apartment in Queens and no love life at all. So it comes as a great shock when she finds herself invited to dinner by one C. Linus Maxwell, a software mega-billionaire and lover of the most gorgeous and accomplished women on Earth. After dining at Manhattan's most exclusive restaurant, he whisks Penny off to a hotel suite in Paris, where he proceeds, notebook in hand, to bring her to previously undreamed-of heights of pleasure. What's not to like? This. Penny discovers she's a test subject for the final development of a line of sexual toys to be marketed in a nationwide chain of boutiques called Beautiful You. These devices are so potent and effective, millions of women are lining up outside the stores on opening day. Maxwell's plan for erotically enabled world domination must be stopped. But how? Carol Monda narrates.
The two paramedics pushed through the crowd. When they first reached her, Penny lashed out, still gasping and struggling, but they calmed her, telling her to relax, telling her that she was safe, the worst was over, leaving her chilled, drenched in sweat, and shivering with shock. In every direction, a wall of faces looked for blank spots where their eyes wouldn't meet other eyes filled with their mutual shame. The paramedics lifted her onto a gurney, and one tucked a blanket around her trembling body while the other buckled straps to keep her in place. Finally, the judge was gaveling, calling for a recess. The medic pulling the straps snug asked, "Can you tell me what year this is?" Penny's throat burned, raw from shouting. Her voice sounded hoarse, but she said the correct year. "Can you tell me the president?" asked the paramedic. Penny almost said Clarissa Hind, but stopped herself. President Hind was dead. The first and only female president was dead. "Can you tell us your name?" Both medics were, of course, male. "Penny," she said. "Penny Harrigan." The two men leaning over her gasped in recognition. Their professional faces slipped for a moment and became delighted smiles. "I thought you looked familiar," one said brightly. The other snapped his fingers, exasperated by words that wouldn't come to mind. He piped in, "You're that one, from the National Enquirer." The first one pointed a finger at Penny, bound and helpless, watched by every masculine eye. "Penny Harrigan," he shouted like an accusation. "You're Penny Harrigan, the nerd Cinderella." The pair of men lifted the gurney to waist height. The crowds parted to let them wheel it toward the exit. The second medic nodded with recognition. "The guy you dumped, wasn't he, like, the richest man in the world?" "Maxwell," the first declared. "His name was Linus Maxwell." He shook his head in disbelief. Not only had Penny been raped in front of a federal courtroom filled with people, none of whom had lifted a finger to stop the attacker, but now the ambulance attendants thought she was an idiot. "You should have married him," the first one kept marveling all the way to the ambulance. "Lady, if you'd married that guy, you'd be richer than God." Cornelius Linus Maxwell, C. Linus Maxwell. Due to his reputation as a playboy, the tabloid press often called him Climaxwell, the world's richest mega-billionaire. Those same tabloids had dubbed her the nerd Cinderella. Penny Harrigan and Corny Maxwell. They'd met a year before. That all seemed like a lifetime ago, a different world entirely. A better world. Never in human history had there been a better time to be a woman. Penny knew that. Growing up, she repeated the fact like a mantra. Never in human history has there been a better time to be a woman. Her world had been perfect, more or less. She'd recently graduated law school in the top third of her class, but failed the bar exam twice. twice. It wasn't self-doubt, not really, but an idea had begun to haunt her. It bothered Penny that, due to all the hard-won victories of women's liberation, becoming an upbeat, ambitious girl attorney didn't feel like much of a triumph. Not anymore. It didn't seem any bolder than to be a housewife in the 1950s. A couple generations ago, society would have encouraged her to be a stay-at-home mom. Now all the pressure was to become a lawyer, or a doctor, or a rocket scientist. Whatever the case, the validity of those roles had more to do with fashion and politics than they did with Penny herself. As a college undergrad, she'd devoted herself to gaining the approval of the professors in her gender studies department at the University of Nebraska. She'd exchanged the dreams of her parents for the dogma of her instructors, but neither of those outlooks was innately her own.
That was Beautiful You by Chuck Palahniuk. Readers, titles for every taste are just a click away. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for a sleigh full of suggestions across the genres. And remember, taking time out with a great book is a perfect way for you to relax. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you back here in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.